Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. What do you have in mind when it comes to the monster Frankenstein? There are iconic movie images, but the fact is they bear little resemblance to the original. For that matter, the popular movie versions that began 100 or so years ago little resemble the novel that inspired them. Mary Shelley's novel, Frankenstein, was written 200 years ago this new year. Washington University has taken the anniversary to heart. Joining us now to tell us why is Corinna Tritell, Associate Professor in the Department of History at Washington University. She is Chief Organizer of the University's Frankenstein Bicentennial Celebration. Corinna, thanks so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
Thank you for having me.
And a Happy New Year to you.
Same.
Why this special interest in Frankenstein at Washington University?
Well, first of all, everyone can relate to Frankenstein. Whether they've read the novel or not, they know about Frankenstein. But Frankenstein is also a great fit for Washington University. We're a university that's really strong in STEM fields, so that's science, technology, engineering, math, and we can tack on medicine, and also the arts and humanities. And Frankenstein is one of those novels that has been drawn into discussions in all of those fields. So it's a perfect opportunity for us to organize a whole series of events and conversations with each other.
And a whole series of events is exactly what you're doing.
I mean, yes.
This is ongoing from beginning of the school year to the end.
Yes. Yes, we started actually in August. The entire freshman class read Frankenstein and met for the same 2 hours right before classes started to talk about the novel. And we had a whole series of events this fall, and several more coming up over the next year.
I'm curious as to what the initial reaction of the students who've read the book have to it, because it is so different from the story most of us know.
Yeah. I'd say that the students' reaction was pretty much your reaction. So most of us know about Frankenstein through pop cultural versions, the film versions. We think that Frankenstein is the monster and that he is this inarticulate, murdering, kind of bumbling and clumsy individual. And so they're very shocked when they read the novel and they discover that Victor Frankenstein was actually a university student, and that the monster is actually not so much a monster in the novel as a creature who's trying to find his way in the world without any teachers or parents.
Right, and the way he was created, totally different from the lightning bolts going into the neck and
yeah,
that sort
right.
of thing. Although there is some murder involved, the monster does do that sort of thing before the book is over.
That's true. There are murders.
Yeah. Let's talk, before we get back to this story a little bit, let's talk about Mary Shelley.
Mm-hmm.
An interesting woman. She, I think, left home at 16 and to take off with a married man.
Mm-hmm.
Pick up the story from there. I mean, she was, 18 or 19 when she wrote this book?
Yeah. So she herself actually came from a remarkable family. Her mother was Mary Wollstonecraft, who is one of the founders of Western feminism. She was a real firebrand, and she actually died giving birth to Mary Shelley. Mary Shelley's father was William Godwin, who was one of the British radicals of the early 19th century. And Mary Shelley herself had a sort of a fraught relationship with her father. And when she was still Mary Godwin, she ran away with Percy Shelley, who was the romantic poet who was married at the time. And she went on a tour of the European continent with him, had a baby, wrote Frankenstein when she was 18 or 19, and then published it a couple of years later as basically an unknown author. She actually published it anonymously. A remarkable woman in the sense that she was self-educated.
And well-educated at that.
And
I mean,
well-educated.
When one reads the book, clearly the language is there and all the other attributes of a great writer. You mentioned the baby, and I saw something in getting ready for our discussion here today that struck me. Apparently there was a journal entry when her baby died right after childbirth, and the journal entry was, "Bad day, baby died."
Yes.
And that's strange.
Yeah. Well, you know, it may be not as strange as you might think. It wasn't atypical for women to lose half of their children very early in life to a whole variety of illnesses in the early 19th century. Yeah, hard to interpret the meaning of something like that, but it certainly wasn't an unexpected event.
And the reason that she wrote this was because there was kind of a challenge amongst her husband and, was it George Gordon, Lord Byron?
Yes, well, that's the story. We don't know what actually happened, but the story that she tells about the origin of the story is that they were holed up with Lord Byron and her stepsister and Percy Shelley and a couple of other friends in this villa in Switzerland, and the weather was really lousy, and they were a bunch of writers, and so they set themselves this ghostwriting contest, who could write the most interesting and scary story about a ghost. And so this is what she – everyone else lost interest in the contest, but this is what she came up with.
Of course, there are no ghosts involved in this.
Well, that's kind of the irony, yes, yeah. That this story is really not a ghost story. It's a very modern, natural story, right? The monster is not supernatural at all. He's made out of human body parts.
Why does this story – has this story resonated for 200 years now?
You know, I started off this whole project of organizing a party for Frankenstein wanting to answer that question, and I don't know if I have a good answer. I think part of the allure of the novel perhaps is that it's very difficult to take sides in the novel. There's actually three different narrators, and one of the narrators in the very center of the novel is the monster. And the monster is actually a very sympathetic creature once you get inside of his head. And so you begin to understand why he murders people, why he behaves so hatefully. Then you read, you know, other people's side of the story and you sympathize with them. So it's a novel that doesn't let you sit comfortably.
It's fascinating as the monster – he's not often called a monster in the book. He's called a demon and a fiend and a couple of other things. But he is in some sort of a shed or something behind a cottage. And he spends months listening to the people inside the cottage interact. Mm-hmm. And that's how he learns – I guess it was French, wasn't it?
He learned French. He's a smart creature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he'd go out at night and collect firewood for them and bring it in. And every morning they'd find firewood. Nobody – really seem to ask, what's this doing here every morning?
Right.
But he was a good guy.
He's trying to be a good guy. Yeah, I think that's part of – I think that is part – now, having taught the novel many times, this is part of what grabs readers about the novel is that they expect the monster to be irredeemably evil. Hmm. And instead what they find is a creature whose parent abandons him, who's trying to do the right thing and has to educate himself. He's smart, right? He teaches himself French and how to read. Mm-hmm. As you say, he tries to gather wood for this poor family. He tries to take care of people to make friends with them. And then because he's rejected by everyone, he becomes very angry and eventually kills others.
He sees himself in his reflection, and he realizes what he looks like. And it's apparently a very hideous look.
He's – well, you know, the novel's actually – so this is another one of those points where the novel doesn't let you take a rest. When he's created, there's a really beautiful passage where the creature is described as beautiful, as having lustrous hair and these beautiful lips and all these fine features. But you're right. When he gets to that point of looking at himself in the pond, he recognizes that he doesn't look like other human beings, and he sees himself as ugly.
And he wants to befriend the people that he's been kind of spying on for lo these many months. And he comes in and talks to the blind father of the family who can't see him to kind of break the ice. But when the rest of the people come into the room, they faint dead away when they see him.
Right. Yes. Yeah. They become afraid. But it's so interesting that the blind man hears the voice of a person who – it was someone who sounds like a person. Mm-hmm. He's not afraid.
Yeah. Well, what about your own interest in this? Obviously, you're probably a little more interested than the average person. What inspired all of that?
Yeah, probably. I think it has to do something with my biography. When I was a college student – so long before I became a historian, I was actually a student in chemistry, and I was very interested in how people like me appeared in novels. And so I started reading Mary Shelley one day with these film versions of Frankenstein in my head, and I was really intrigued because Victor Frankenstein was someone just like me. He was actually a university student who was studying chemistry, mm-hmm. And he was doing these really cool experiments. And as I kept on reading, I became very intrigued because, of course, these experiments didn't turn out very well. Yeah. And, you know, there generations of students have asked, what is it that went wrong? Should he have not done the experiments in the first place? Was it because he didn't take responsibility for the creature afterwards? So I was very interested in the novel in my science incarnation.
Why did he create the monster? Was it because his mother had recently died and he wanted to see if he could animate dead tissue?
Well, that was probably one reason. Yeah, he was very devastated by the loss of his mother, and he gives these speeches early on in the novel where he talks about wanting to give a gift to humanity so that they don't have to suffer losing loved ones the way that he did. But I think there's also a lot of hubris, you know, that drives him. He wants to do something that no one else has done before. And, you know, maybe it's worth thinking back to 200 years ago. The thought of a human being acting as a creator rather than a divinity being the creator, that was extremely transgressive. Yeah. So Victor Frankenstein was taking the mantle of God onto himself for a lot of readers in the 19th century.
And then it raises the question, who was the real monster, doesn't it?
Yes, and that's a question I always like to ask readers when I lead a discussion of the novel, and you'd actually be surprised at the range of responses. There's one half of the room always wants to accuse Victor Frankenstein of being the monster for having been so irresponsible in the experiments he did, and then the treatment that he gave this creature, which was basically abandonment. And then there are others who really think that the creature should shoulder responsibility for his own actions. So we've had some very passionate debates about that.
I have to take a break now, but we must point out before that the monster never had a name.
That's right.
We gave the monster the name
over
the years. No name. Frankenstein was the creator of this being. I'm talking with Corinna Tritell, associate professor at the Department of History at Washington University, and we're talking about Mary Shelley's book, Frankenstein. It was written exactly 200 years ago. Back to continue the conversation. If you'd like to be a part of it, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org, or if you'd prefer to send a tweet, we'll take it at STL on air. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back as we continue our conversation with Corinna Tritell. We are talking about Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. The issue of otherness, of diversity and inclusion, is really a strong theme in this book, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes. The creature is really the quintessential outsider. And the question is, how does he become an outsider? Is it something that's essential to his creation, or is it sort of an effect of the way that the people he encounters treat him? And, you know, part of what we're doing at Washington University is tracking the 200-year conversation around the significance of the monster's otherness.
And again, the reaction of the students so far to that, I mean, given this community and some of the things that have gone on here,
yes.
I just wonder how they're reacting to that.
They get it right away. And In fact, some of the events that we're organizing, both at Washington University and here in St. Louis, sort of examine the St. Louis piece of this story of otherness in the novel. So, for instance, in the fall, and this will be an event that's open to the public, we're inviting the graphic novelist Victor Laval, who's just released a new comic book series called Destroyer, which retells the story of Frankenstein against the backdrop of Black Lives Matters. So he'll be here. He'll be talking with the audience about how you recreate stories like this in a moment like ours.
You can really use a story like this to connect a lot of dots between the story of 200 years ago and, as you indicated in the earlier part of our conversation, about some of the things that are animating discussion today, cloning, stem cell research, which you mentioned, and some of the things like that. Mm-hmm. I guess there are some interesting discussions.
Yes. In fact, one of our other events, also open to the public in the fall, will be Jennifer Doudna, who's a professor of biochemistry at UC Berkeley, and she's one of the inventors of CRISPR gene editing technology, which is a really it's been in the news a lot. And she's coming to talk about CRISPR and social responsibility. Frankenstein is always invoked, you know, in these discussions about gene editing. So she'll be here also talking about that piece.
We have an email from Marta who asks, is the Washington University Medical School involved in recognizing this bicentennial?
Yes, that's a good question. There is going to be a series of events at the WashU Medical School next September, I think. And there will be, I think there's going to be a recreation of an alchemical experiment because there's alchemy in the novel. There will be discussions of medical ethics and patient treatment and a whole series of things like that.
Is this sort of thing, to your knowledge, going on at other colleges and universities?
Yeah, you know, I know that there were a few other universities this year that assigned Frankenstein as the first year reading. So Emory, for instance, did that. The other big celebration that I know about is at Arizona State University. Mm-hmm. And they're doing also very interesting things, quite different. They're taking a very contemporary scientific spin on the novel. But, you know, the novel is incredibly flexible. So there are a whole variety of celebrations that can be organized in its honor.
Let's take a call. We have Terry wants to get into this conversation, so let's bring Terry in. Thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment that there was a series on Showtime called Penny Dreadful that dealt with classic literary characters like Dr. Frankenstein and Dorian Gray, etc., and they showed the monster. It was based much more on the, you know, original story, and it was just absolutely fascinating how much the series humanized and showed the humanity of the monster and actually all the characters. And it was called Penny Dreadful because, you know, back in London and the Victorian era, the publishers or writers would publish these books that you could buy for a dollar because they were about dreadful, scary stories. So that's what I was told, that the series is called Penny Dreadful because of that. And like I said, it's just absolutely fascinating how the character of the monster is so, the viewers are so empathetic to him. And it's just really a beautiful take on the story, much more closer to the original book than anything that I've ever seen in movies or other things. So I just wanted to bring that up if anybody was interested. It was on Showtime a couple years ago, and there's only three seasons, but it's really interesting.
Thanks, Terry.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a good observation. I'm a historian, so I'm interested in the 200-year history of this, and I think that we have now come back around to where Mary Shelley was when she wrote the novel, which she shows a lot of sympathy towards the monster. But the theatrical and movie adaptations over the 100 years after 1818, the attempt was always to push viewers to hate the monster and fear the monster. And I'd say something happened in the maybe the 80s, 1980s, 1990s, and now since the turn of the century that all of a sudden our sympathies really seem to be directed again to the monster. So there's a changing relationship between readers and viewers, I think, in the story as well.
I wonder if the television version of the Munsters had anything to do with that.
Yes.
Because the Fred Gwynne character looked a lot like the iconic version of Frankenstein.
Yeah, it could. I think we've also become much more sensitive about the experiences of different kinds of people. And so perhaps we read the novel differently, you know, than we did 200 years ago.
How was the novel received? My understanding is that it was done in three volumes, if you will. It's a relatively short book, but
yes.
Three volumes.
Yes, it is a very short book. So it was published anonymously. It was reviewed pretty favorably by a few critics, and then it kind of went away. And what put Frankenstein back on the public radar in Britain was that a playwright got hold of the story and rewrote his own version. There was a theatrical version of this called Presumption that was performed on the London stage in the 1820s, and it was a big popular success. And that was the way in which Frankenstein kind of became popularized. Most audiences in the 19th century actually knew Frankenstein through theatrical adaptations rather than through reading the novel themselves, similar to our own experience with the movies.
Well, yeah, I was surprised to learn that the first Frankenstein movie, we talked about this off the air, was more than 100 years ago in the early part of the 20th century.
Yes, it's the 1910 Edison, and it's freely available on the internet. So you can download it, and it's about a 10-minute version of the Frankenstein story. And the monster really is a monster. He's scary. Victor Frankenstein's not really a science student. He's an alchemist. And it's, you know, it's a silent movie, but it's worth looking at. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a beautiful adaptation.
In the conversations that you're having with students, does the subject of artificial intelligence come up? It's been such a discussion point recently, and I was wondering if we're connecting dots between creating things, if that's been an issue.
You know, the students actually have not been interested in the artificial intelligence piece, but that could change next year. You know, every generation knows something else. Their interest right now is with CRISPR and gene editing. That's where they really see the connection.
Are these just students who are medical students or science students, or
no,
are these of the broad range?
No, this is the beauty of Frankenstein, is that you can sit around a table, people from very different backgrounds, students who want to be doctors or engineers, students who want to be artists, students who want to be historians. They can sit down together and actually have an exchange of views about something like gene editing technology through the novel. Yeah, so they're from everywhere.
What was the initial reaction of students when they were told that it was required reading? I mean,
asked them that. Some of them rolled their eyes because many of them had read Frankenstein in high school. You know, it's not atypical for people to read Frankenstein when they're 13 or 14. But they said that they were really glad that the university required them to read the novel because they realized that they had missed so much and that they needed to have the conversation with other people who had very different takes on the novel in order to understand how much they hadn't seen the first time.
Well, I missed it altogether. And as I mentioned to you earlier, that I was so happy that we had the opportunity to talk to you, gave me the opportunity to read the book, and I'm glad I did.
Yeah.
I mean, as I've said to people, once you get used to the rhythm of the language of that time, it's really a fun and very interesting read.
It's gripping.
When you we don't have much time left, but when you created a study guide, what particular questions did you want to raise with the students other than those that we've talked about? We talked about otherness and inclusiveness and that sort of thing, social responsibility. Mm-hmm. What other things did you want to challenge them with?
Well, those were the two big ones, but I also wanted them to think about how much Frankenstein is part of their kind of cultural toolbox and that they've sort of they drank Frankenstein through the water, you know, by growing up in an English language culture. And for them to think a little bit about Frankenstein as a metaphor that has this long and rich history that they're a part of, and that they will also be participating in remaking the story themselves. You know, perhaps we have someone out there who will be doing the next version of the Penny Dreadfuls, perhaps on radio, right, or on TV or in some other media.
Well, let's see.
Let's see.
In any case, it's a great story, and it's a brand new story as far as I'm concerned, and I think readers who are not familiar with it. I want to thank you, Corinna Tritel, so much for being with us. This has been a very interesting session for me, and I hope for the audience as well. Congratulations on what you're doing, and hope you have a great year with the rest of the programs you're going to be conducting.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great talking to you. Corinna Tritel, Associate Professor in the Department of History at Washington University. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.